It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We explore green burials now, or the term natural barriers. What is involved in environmentally sustainable death care practices? The historic Viroqua Cemetery is preparing to open a natural barrier preserve with its cemetery and about 20 acres of meadow. Join in on natural burial methods and practices. 800-642-1234. Conversation right here, 800-642-1234. Gail Free is president of the Viroqua Cemetery Association in southwestern Wisconsin in the Driftless. Gail, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning. So where are you at in the development on this plan to add green burials to the land?
Well, we approved it at the association, and now we started our fundraiser, but we have to hire we hired a landscape architect that specializes in green burial cemetery layout and long-term planning. And then we have to do site prep and establish a walking path. We need to lay out and mark the actual burial plots and then use a surveyor to create an accurate computer map. And all during this time, this winter, we'll be creating green burial rules of operation and updating our original cemetery bylaws. It's a larger project than people think.
I would imagine. What makes a green burial, whether it's a service or a cemetery or a product, is there any accrediting or natural verification approval process?
The Green Burial Council has a complete approval process and certification process, but we're not totally interested in all of that. We're just interested in providing this new green burial option so that we can meet the needs of the entire community.
When you hear the term green burial, how do you define it?
I define it as going back to the old ways of a more natural way of burial.
And what is involved in those old ways, those natural ways?
Well, you don't need, we don't use embalming. We don't use concrete or metal vaults. A person is buried a little shallower than a conventional vault is buried. It helps with the decomposition. And, you know, we'd like to be around forever, but unfortunately, no matter what we do, we're going to decompose. That's nature's way.
You mentioned preparing this land, these acres, and you know, some green cemeteries, they do land management practices that encourage native plants or prairie restoration. Will you do any land restoration on this acreage as you prepare it for these graves?
We are very fortunate. We have a natural area. It's a wooded area with basically narrow farm fields running through it, and it's already an established meadow with natural meadow grasses like a pasture land would be. We have very little, we're not real interested in a prairie because that would involve killing what we have now, and it takes years to establish a prairie, and we have a very beautiful green meadow already established.
How much interest have you received from the community to hold green burials there?
It just blows me away. What really helps is we have a local Green Burial Alliance group that has been educating the public for many, many years. And you would think the people requesting green burial are baby boomers and the younger people that are more vocal on environmental issues, but our support is far-reaching. This is a very conservative farming community, and old farmers who have taken care of their land their entire life see green burial as a common sense approach to their legacy of land stewardship. We also have a large population of organic farmers in Vernon County, and green burial is a good fit with their mission.
Some green cemeteries don't allow traditional headstones or grave markers. What will be your policy at Viroqua Cemetery for this area?
It's not totally established yet, but we're leaning towards flat stone markers locally sourced stone.
How
I mean, I think everybody deserves some kind of a marker.
I was going to say, how do you feel about that issue? Because, you know, if everyone deserves some type of marker then, but you also want to be environmentally minded, what is that balance?
Well, it's a real balance. And what some of the modern cemetery, green burial cemeteries are going is all GPS. But you got to remember, this is a conservative area. And a lot of us are old school. We use GPS, but we don't think it's appropriate in a cemetery. We will have a map in the entrance, and there will be some sort of a marker, so you will be able to go visit a loved one in the future.
Gail Free leads the nonprofit Viroqua Cemetery Association, operated and managed by volunteer members, as we learn about its steps toward creating a green burial section. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show, and there's more conversation ahead on green burials on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Viroqua Cemetery is preparing to open a natural burial preserve within its cemetery grounds. And the fundraising group, the Driftless Green Burial Alliance, is working with the Cemetery Association to develop southwestern Wisconsin's first public natural burial ground. Join in 800-642-1234. Conversation right here, 800-642-1234. Gail Free is president of the Viroqua Cemetery Association, stays with us. Let's bring in Diane now in Iron County. Diane, what's on your mind?
Hi. I would really think it'd be cool to have one of those up in Iron County with all the land we have. I found out that they're making one in Ironwood, Michigan. However, they said they're going the grass above the green burials forever. So that's not very green. That's going to create a lot of CO2.
Diane, thank you for that. So Diane's saying that they're going to continue to cut the grass to mow. Gail, your thoughts there?
It depends upon the grasses, but there's no real need to mow the grass continually. We're planning on mowing it maybe twice a year once it reaches 8 to 12 inches tall. The walking path will be mowed, of course, but with a natural meadow, the grass will never get more than a foot and a half tall.
If a county is considering this, or a cemetery association somewhere else is considering to do a section for natural burials, do you have any tips or advice?
Proceed cautiously when you're developing the rules. We're just starting with that. But bear in mind, the rules you start with are the rules that people 100 years from now are going to be dealing with.
So you have to really think deliberately as to what impact that will have for generations to come. And you and your staff, they took a 12-week masterclass on green burials. What key rules and regulations should people know about with this process?
Oh, well, I don't know where to start on that. But this masterclass was perfect for me because I had so many unanswered questions. As far as rules and regulations, it's basically common sense of body prep and accepting the body at the cemetery and how you lower the body and family involvement. You know, it just goes on and on. So we're including funeral directors and anyone interested to help us develop the rules.
How does the cost of green burials compare to cremation or traditional burials?
I think it's going to be pretty much the same. It should be less costly, but, you know, the lots are going to be about the same price. And there's the main thing, the people requesting green burials have very seldom mentioned cost. They want the family participation and the environmental aspects of the green burial more important than cost.
You estimate more than half of the burials at the Viroqua Cemetery now involve cremation. How is the rising popularity of cremation affecting, burials in general?
Well, it doesn't affect burials in general, but it kind of affects the cemetery because all cemeteries struggle financially, and we don't make much money with a cremation burial.
Do you think green burials could provide a boost to your cemetery for the future? Is this the wave of the future?
Absolutely. That's one of the reasons we looked into it, is because we think green burial will give us a little financial stability in the future. You know, unfortunately, it takes money to run and maintain a 40-acre-plus cemetery.
How are you working with the Driftless Green Burial Alliance to make this possible?
Oh, they're a very important partner in this, and they're on my committee to develop the rules. And the big thing they're doing now is they're helping us with the fundraising.
Gail, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Gail Free is president of the Viroqua Cemetery Association. Up ahead on the morning show, Wisconsin is one of 20 states requiring Holocaust in K-12 schools. We talk with the head of a local Jewish education center about the state mandate. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. News Update is next on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Evers signed into law last year that Wisconsin middle and high school social studies classes teach the Holocaust and other genocides. And under this law, public schools and charter schools and private schools in the voucher program, they must include this curriculum at least once between 5th and 8th grade and once in high school. Join in on this instruction, 800-642-1234. Conversation is at 800-642-1234. Samantha Abramson is here, Executive Director of the Nathan and Esther Pelz Holocaust Education Resource Center, a program of the Milwaukee Jewish Federation, providing model curriculum. Samantha, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, explain where you're at, how the education about the Holocaust is rolling out in schools. Where is the curriculum at this point?
So, you know, I should say at the offset that rather than creating one curriculum, what is happening in Wisconsin right now, and our colleagues at the Department of Public Instruction are not on today, but they are also working on their own set of guidelines, which I believe are going to be made public soon. What we're doing at our organization, you know, knowing that educators in schools across the state in both urban and rural settings are now going to need to implement this law in their classrooms, we have created a website. It's called teachholocaust.org. Anybody can go on and look at it for free. It has over 100 lesson plans on it. These lesson plans were curated by our team at HERC. They come from the trusted sources in the world, including the Holocaust Museum in DC, Echoes and Reflections, Facing History in Ourselves. And those lesson plans have been custom matched to meet social studies standards for Wisconsin specifically.
You've also, I'm sorry to jump in here.
Go ahead.
But you've also been training teachers as well. What work are you doing there?
Exactly. So right, having the website is a great start. And now we are actually sending our education team across the state. We physically drive to the different regions across the state, and we are training teachers on best practices in Holocaust education, knowing full well that this content is so profoundly important for our students in Wisconsin, but also really, really complicated, really hard to teach. So we have two-day workshops that we bring to school districts across the state. We have trained teachers from 232 school districts already. And we plan to reach the other 200 or so school districts this year yet. And the training is going very well overall. Schools are embracing Holocaust education in their classrooms, and administrators are telling us that HERC has helped their teachers feel more equipped and confident to teach these challenging lessons.
I wonder what comes up for teachers in these training sessions. What do you hear, and what are some of the concerns they have as they handle this material?
You know, I think we hear it all. You know, it's because it is so complicated. We're talking about, you know, the genocide, the mass murder of a people. And in the case of the Holocaust, it was often everyday citizens who were involved in the killings or in murders of others. We, you know, teachers really want to understand how the Holocaust happened so that they can show their students. And so that the students can make connections between the past and the present. You know, our goal with Holocaust education is to make sure that students learn from these lessons. These lessons are universal. Our goal is that by teaching about the Holocaust and other genocides and helping the educators be empowered to teach about the Holocaust, they're helping train the next generation of leaders who are going to help us prevent future genocides.
Samantha, students, they will encounter, as you know, neo-Nazism, white supremacy. They'll encounter hate speech on social media and symbols. What do you teach teachers about this aspect of their students' digital lives?
Exactly. You know, Stu, teachers, you know, from us, they learn that this is all happening, that anti-Semitism in our country and globally, and certainly other forms of hate as well, it's on the rise on the social media platforms you mentioned and in other places too. So we want awareness. We want everyone to know that this is still happening. And we want teachers to know that they can come to us for resources to combat Holocaust denial. We're able to coach educators one-on-one when they encounter a lesson plan they want to use, but they don't quite know how to use it. Or often we're brought in when something goes wrong in a classroom setting where there is a swastika that's drawn on a chalkboard or something. You know, we can come in and give education to those students.
How dangerous is Holocaust denial?
Incredibly. If we do, as a people, cannot agree that the Holocaust happened, and that if we continue to have these voices that tell us that Holocaust didn't happen, then the memory of those we lost during the Holocaust, that memory is ebbed. And we want to make sure that Holocaust remains a central part of our learning. Because without that, without wrestling with that history, without acknowledging what happened, it could happen again. It could happen here in this country. It could happen anywhere.
Samantha Abramson with us, Executive Director of Milwaukee's Holocaust Education Resource Center. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Samantha, I would imagine you think about this a lot, but age appropriateness and how you handle materials for, you know, children 5th through 8th grade versus what is taught at the high school level. You know, how can this history be taught in an age appropriate way?
Thank you for asking the question. It's so important to make sure that everything we're teaching is age appropriate. We want to make sure that we're not traumatizing students. The goal is not to shock. The goal is not to give the students nightmares at night. Our goal is to make sure that students develop that empathy, that compassion for their fellow human beings. And graphic images are not something you will see in most of our curriculums. We have made that decision, and that is in line with most Holocaust education practices nowadays. So for a 5th grader, we're really going to focus more on that empathy building, making sure that the individual stories hold true, that students get to learn from primary sources. And we'll continue that in the high school setting as well. But by high school, we can ask more complex questions, such as, you know, what was the role of everyday bystanders in allowing the Holocaust to unfold? And what did America know? And what should we have done in this country or not done? So it's, you know, it does change as the ages move along, but we always want to build that empathy, and we never want to scare.
Last year, my fifth grader, well, I guess my then fifth grader, read Making Bombs for Hitler in as part of classwork, and in the historical fiction book that's based off the horrors faced, you know, being a child in Nazi-controlled camps. How do you feel about teaching that book or other books? What are your insights there?
You know, that book I'm not as familiar with, but I can tell you that as far as other historic fiction, graphic novels, when done correctly, those can be really wonderful entry points for students. We've definitely used mouse in our lesson plans, for example.
Yes.
And we find absolute value in those materials. They're not a complete story of the Holocaust, and really no one book or source ever can be a complete source on the Holocaust. But historic fiction and graphic novels for students can be a really terrific resource.
We just heard from Jeff in Appleton, called in and couldn't stay with us, but Jeff assumed that the Holocaust was already being taught in schools and was wondering why a law was needed to mandate that it be taught.
Good question. We get that one a lot too. So it was, you know, the reason why we wanted the mandate was because it was not being taught consistently across the state. We found that, you know, some school districts were dedicating 2 full weeks to Holocaust education, which was fantastic. And there were some school districts that really weren't covering it at all. It was maybe a footnote in the larger discussion of World War II. And we, you know, we really feel quite passionately that Holocaust education is a universal need. And that is why we pushed to have this mandate passed.
What can parents and caregivers do as their child moves through a unit about the Holocaust or other genocides? What can conversations be like at home?
Checking in with your student is essential for this process because the learning doesn't stop in the classroom. The whole goal of Holocaust education is that these lessons are actually going to come home, that these lessons are going to help you know, make your students overall a more empathetic, a more accepting person. So as a parent or a caregiver, asking your student what lessons they learned in class that day, you know, asking them if they see any trends or any red flags that they learned about genocide and the Holocaust in today's world, making those connections is always really important.
And when you said today's world, can teaching about the Holocaust, you know, maybe used as a gateway for discussing human rights issues or civil rights issues? I mean, do you see this perhaps as a springboard into other atrocities now?
You know, absolutely. The Holocaust can address the human consequences of genocide. It can address anti-Semitism, racism, bullying, public indifference, bureaucratic red tape that related to immigration. It can address so many things. What we want to be cautious of is remembering that each genocide, including the Holocaust, is unique. We don't want to equate one with the other. We don't want to make false comparisons because that's not doing a justice to the memory of the victims. But we can make those connections. Yes, there are connections to be made between the history and today.
Samantha, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Samantha Abramson is Executive Director of the Milwaukee Jewish Federation's Holocaust Education Resource Center. Just ahead, we talked with a UW-Madison archivist about the history of recorded music. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.